Welcome to this very special edition, a Climatech edition of Great Minds. And with us today is James Walker. James is the Chief Executive Officer of Nano Nuclear Energy. They are literally redefining what we all think of as nuclear energy in a very real way, a very big part of the transition that's undergoing globally as to where our energy comes from, where we source it historically, where we are today, more importantly, James, where we're going tomorrow. You'll be on the agenda and on stage with us in Boston at Climatech next week. A special thanks to our mutual friend, your colleague, Wayne Howe, for putting this all together. We're very grateful to Wayne for everything he has done to contribute to Climatech, and absolutely thrilled to talk to you. So a hearty welcome.
No, thank you very much, Matthew. That was a lovely introduction.
Well, we have a team of writers, you know, working 24/7. So, James, you know, our backgrounds could not be more opposite. You know, I only got through high school physics because we had a teacher, Mr. Posner, I remember his name, who was once on an old American game show called Bowling for Dollars.
Did he win?
He did very well. And I don't remember if he won, but I know he did well. And I remember, if you look up on YouTube, you can find clips of Bowling for Dollars. It could not be more exactly what you think it is. It's just hysterical and really awful, really awful. But Mr. Posner was on Bowling for Dollars and he won a lot of money. And anytime there was going to be like a test or a surprise quiz, we would distract him and say, could you tell us that story again of when you were on Bowling for Dollars?
Very clever.
Like, and I think that was the only way I even passed the class in 11th grade at Cardozo High School. You go to University of Nottingham and dive right into mechanical engineering. You're probably 17, 18 years old. That comes from somewhere. Talk about where that passion for engineering comes from, and I assure you the Mr. Posner story is the only one that I will have during this episode, so the heavy load is about to be carried by you.
Well, you know, the want to do engineering was partly because I wasn't confident enough in my own writing where I could objectively assess that I was deserving of the marks, whereas in something that's mathematical based, you either know it's either 100% right or it's just wrong. And there's some security in that. So it cannot get left up to the subjectivity of the marker. And so you think, if I can just get good at the maths, then I can sort of guarantee my marks and nobody can really get in the way of those. So that's part of the consideration around why I liked maths-based things. But also there's a satisfaction to understand the world through maths. Like if you can start modeling the way things actually work, and if you really want to build anything, you've got to be able to model it, and to model it you need a very good foundation in applied physics and maths, and it can become quite good fun. I mean, obviously it sounds nerdy, but like once you start getting good at it, it can be quite good fun. It's like problem solving. I think humans on all levels to a certain extent, like some level of problem solving.
No, I don't think it sounds nerdy at all. I just think it's the type of thing that some people have a head for it and some don't. And I think to recognize at that age that, hey, I want to take the subjectivity out of it. This is where I have confidence. This is where I don't. That's a lot of real self-awareness. Not everybody that young has a feel for it. You not only excel at Nottingham, but then you go on to Exeter, mineral and geotechnical engineering, and then dive into nuclear physics. Talk about that trajectory. You spent about as much time as someone who becomes a traditional medical doctor does in your academic training, and in many ways mirrored the level of depth and knowledge and understanding with what you accomplished in the nuclear space. So that must have been an interesting time. You were in school for a very long time.
I was in school for quite a while. When I finished the mechanical engineering degree, you're still a young man. You still want adventure and you think, Well, if I do a mining engineering degree, mining can take you anywhere in the world to remote locations, and like there's some adventure involved in that while you're still doing a discipline that is interesting and you're fairly good at it. So I got into that, but upon graduating from that master's in mining engineering, I actually got offered a pretty good job with the Ministry of Defence in the UK. And they wanted me as a mechanical engineer on their submarine program. And because I got involved in that, they thought I had suitable promise enough that they pushed me to go do a nuclear physics and nuclear engineering master's that was paid. And I wasn't going to turn down a free master's that the government paid for. And I also got my, as a young guy, when you're getting a salary on top of free education, you're like, this is the best deal ever. You know, I just get to. I went off and did my nuclear physics master's, and then upon graduating that, I started working for the Ministry of Defence as a nuclear engineer and building reactors for submarines. I got seconded to Rolls-Royce for a while. I worked as a physicist in the design of the next generation of nuclear reactors, and so I did nuclear for a fair amount of time.
All right. So wait, you're going way too fast. You already jumped to Rolls-Royce.
Sorry,
Let
Matthew.
no, that's okay. This is fantastic. So let's stay with the Ministry of Defense for a little bit, because I think another, the prescient move to understand your strengths, entering university, and then on the back end, using the military as a great first employer, pay pretty good. You get, certainly look very nice. And they paid for your master's, so that's all pretty good. Let's dive deeper here, which normally on Great Minds we don't do, but given that this is the Climate Tech Edition, we're talking about some very heady issues. And let's talk about a report that you submitted to the Admiralty around looking at a different type of reactor for remote deployment. And I think it was using molten salt. It was a different technology, but that's not an area, James, in fairness, that I would normally, go that deep on something. But how in the Lord's name do you think of that? And what does it actually mean? Because I can only say the words. I have no idea what it means.
It's actually you've actually done your homework pretty well, because I haven't touched on this subject in quite a while. But while I was at the Ministry of Defence and I finished that master's, the government wanted to look at solutions to for remote power, principally for military applications. And there had been a lot of development work done in the molten salt. And what molten salt essentially is it's a composite of different things. So fluorine, lithium, potassium, sodium, all sort of mesh together. But the advantage here over a conventional reactor is that it has a much higher boiling point. Whereas water in a conventional reactor, it boils at 100 degrees. But if you want to shrink a reactor right down, then your power is going to be much more concentrated. Your power is more concentrated. It's going to boil that water much more. And so you either need a big pressurizer to keep it from boiling over, or you have a salt that can house more heat. And so the salt route was why we chose that for the potential investigation that we were looking at for solutions to for the reactor. And then around that, a lot of the other materials that went into it, I remember it was a graphite moderated reactor. Graphite's a very standard moderator. And the most controversial decision we made is we looked at TRISO fuel. And maybe a lot of people know much background about nuclear fuels, but TRISO, the Department of Energy in the United States had invested well over $1 billion into licensing and approving TRISO fuel for the purposes of advanced nuclear technology. And so obviously being across the pond, we saw that and thought, well, that's a great fuel to be able to use, and there's lots of advantages with this sort of pebble-based fuel. And so we opted to choose that, and we did obviously an assessment of the technology, whereas molten salt, graphite moderated, TRISO reactor. And so me and a team worked on that for quite a while to give, but like actually I've got to admit, a conclusion of the reactor was that once we reached the end of the design study and we needed to go our separate ways, that one, a lot more work was needed, and two, there might be better solutions than what we're working on. So
So just at a macro level, I don't think any of us have any insight into how much money our governments spend on projects like this that never see the light of day. I would think along the way, things get discovered that were unintended, that have a use that was unintended, and/or things here. I mean, that notion of compressing energy and making it almost mobile. When we get to nano, we're going to talk about that, what that means today in 2024. But you could sort of see for you, James, some of those early seeds being planted right here.
Yeah, I mean, certainly doing all that kind of work was very informative for later in my career, like in within nano, where I can understand alternative concepts fairly quickly. And when I work with the more with design teams, where these are very advanced professors with a lot of experience in the nuclear industry, I can keep up with what they're talking about and understand, and actually be able to contribute meaningfully, which is the most important part. But in terms of, how much the government spend on this kind of stuff, I'm sure they're investigating all sorts of things, which is end up being a waste of money. But you never know where they'll lead. I mean, a lot of the technology we use today comes out of the military. I think satellite navigation systems, all that kind of thing, all this, like the Apollo programs, led to huge benefits, I think, for the technology sector. And nuclear certainly has been very good at advancing material science, and that would have had a net benefit across all industries. So,
Right. That horizontal benefit that may be unexpected or unintended, but very real. So, all right, you mentioned it, but now let's jump into Rolls-Royce. We think of Rolls-Royce for the automobiles, of course, airplane engines, other technology. You were in their thermal hydraulics engineering division. What does that mean?
When I was working with the Ministry of Defence, I got seconded to Rolls-Royce, and they were working on the next generation of submarines. And the next generation of submarines needed the next generation nuclear reactors, which really is just a modified old reactor, but optimized and improved upon based on lessons learned. So I first got put in the thermal hydraulics team at Rolls-Royce, where I was investigating channel flow. So thermal heat, hydraulics, water, or fluid rather, and that's how that word breaks down. So I was really looking at channel performance and how fluid moves through the reactors, and looking how to optimize flow rates, the removal of heat through these channels, and across fuel plates, so the reactor would obviously optimize, be able to be optimized. So I did that for a significant amount of time before Rolls-Royce moved me to the nuclear physics department, and I worked there on model verification. So before you build anything, you model everything in physics software, like probabilistic physics software, like Monte Carlo simulations. And I would take real life reactors, and I would model them in the probabilistic physics software, and then I would match the two and make modifications to the code so that the code more closely resembled real life simulation. So,
And when you're building a model, James, is it all within the framework of that software, or are there cases where you're literally, there's a lab and you're building something?
it's kind of done concurrently. So as you build out the models, you'll do things like you'll build a rig, and that rig might not have nuclear material in it, but you'll push water through it. And you'll simulate the environment of a reactor, and then you'll match the rig to the model. And then as the models and the design becomes more sophisticated, you'll build prototype reactors. And then you begin to start collecting data that you'll need to go to the licensing authority. And the civil side works exactly the same way. So within nano, we're now building rigs, and those rigs are to verify the models. And as they both optimize each other, then you start getting into rigs that'll have nuclear material in. And once you get to that sort of stage, you're really building your prototype. And your prototype, you're going to optimize that to a point where then you are ready to go to licensing. And you'll take that product, get it licensed, and then it's a commercial product you can sell on the market.
Amazing trajectory. And what was it like working at what, from the outside looking in, is one of the world's great bellwether companies?
Well, it's, you know, when you're, I mean, it's a very prestigious company. People don't associate it with nuclear, even though Rolls-Royce has been building nuclear reactors for the Navy for, I don't know, what was it now, 60 years, 70 years, something like that. So it's, when you say Rolls-Royce, people think of cars or jet engines. But if you say Rolls-Royce nuclear, usually the reaction is, what the hell, what on earth is that?
Well, listen, it's not like you're going down on Park Lane to the nuclear reactor dealership as you are buying a Rolls-Royce car or seeing Rolls-Royce, outside an airplane window. The average consumer, James, does not actually interact with nuclear.
No, that's it. And but you know, the reason why Rolls-Royce built the submarines was actually a US decision, because the father of the US submarine program, or rather the father of the US Navy nuclear Navy program, was a guy called Admiral Rickover, as a US admiral. But when he was working with the UK to build up their nuclear submarine program, and their he basically just said, it's going to be Rolls-Royce and that's it. And as far as the UK was concerned, they just did exactly what Admiral Rickover told them to do. So ever since then, like, it's been the company that's built the reactor systems for the Navy. So
Incredible. Staying in this general military infantry line of conversation, you spent a number of years as a reservist in the British Army.
I did, yeah, that's
Was
right.
any
So
of
I was.
that active? Was that anything interesting during that 5, 6 year period?
Yes, there was activity in that. So I was sent abroad a couple times. But it was sort of non-conventional warfare, because I wasn't in a conventional infantry unit.
All right, so no actual combat duty,
So there was combat.
but deployment. You were deployed.
There was deployment and there was combat duty, yes. But it wasn't in an Afghanistan or Iraq sort of theater. It was sort of in a non-conventional role, but active. So
Okay, all right, I got you. You continue to advance. You end up working with the Ministry of Defense again in a different way. I guess before making a big leap to the private sector. Anything worth going back on that sort of return back to the Ministry of Defense?
yeah, so after I worked for Rolls-Royce and I got that out of the way, I returned back to the Ministry of Defence, where I worked as, one, I was the chief engineer on the project manager, or the chief project manager, for the nuclear fuel reclamation plant. So that's taking fuel plates and recycling them through a chemical process to recover fuel. So there was an old chemical plant at Rolls-Royce that needed to be redone. So I was responsible for kicking off that project and like planning for the incident, the revamping and the new siting, and how the new facility would look. So that was something I was chiefly in charge of, but I also had other responsibilities too. I was one of the engineers as well that was involved in the core manufacturing facilities, and those were the facilities that actually built the reactor cores for the submarines. And I was part of a team there that worked on the project management of those facilities, the engagement with the workers there. And another role I had as well is that, because I was the chief engineer on the nuclear fuel reclamation plant, I ended up the UK subject matter expert for nuclear fuel reclamation. So I was the go-to point at that point in the UK government for how fuel should be reclaimed and the processes involved. I think I did that for 3 or 4 years before I decided on a move to North America, and then moved into the private sector. So.
Right. Well, you built a hell of a foundation before you made that move. Let me ask you a layman's question. A friend of mine lives in a beautiful new home that was built sort of at the end of what's been a long time industrial site. A lot of energy, a lot of power. Doesn't look, not nuclear, but electric, more traditional old line power. Can you ever really clean up a site that has housed that type of use of energy, irrespective of the genre of energy, if you will, and make that land habitable? I always worry about that when I see that.
Well, it's a good question, because It obviously depends on the extent of the infrastructure that's been installed, but for some of these facilities, that the foundations can go pretty deep. And in those sort of cases, it's not really worth digging up all of that stuff. And it might be worth just going over the top of it and what's the word? Terraforming almost over the top of it. A lot of the big infrastructure can be removed. But like I think for certain things, like take coal power plants as an example, is that now they're looking to try and replace a lot of old coal power plants with nuclear plants because the infrastructure is already there. You just the coal's exhausted. It makes sense that with all the power lines and infrastructure and grids available, you can build a nuclear facility there, and it just takes advantage of that existing infrastructure. But it's also kind of on the understanding that's the best thing you can really do with that site because a complete cleanup, while possible, is not as economically beneficial as installing just a new plant there and would be costly and time consuming without an economic return. But you can't, certainly in the case of nuclear, you are not allowed to build anything unless there is a sufficiently well developed and there's funding for it. Reclamation plan to do with the decommissioning of the site and return and restoring it to it's the natural environment as far as the as you're actually able to do that. There are certain things with certain plants that cause issues. So I mentioned coal a second ago. Now coal produces a lot of coal ash, and that is actually quite radioactive, which not a lot of people know. So you have with coal, you have certain radioactive liabilities that you need to be able to deal with effectively. So the type of plant can really dictate how long it takes, how costly it's going to be, how much infrastructure is going to be left, whether you need to leave some of it there. And a lot of the time, a lot of these groups will, even if they have a plan in place, look to be able to swap over to some other system. So a lot of the, so they don't need to disassemble this stuff because it's very expensive to install and could potentially be useful for other things. So.
So I think the answer to my question might be it could be a little shaky.
It could be like that is part of it. Now it will obviously well it depends on the scenario and the case
Right,
and the
right. No
plant and
universal rule,
no universal
but
rule.
as an overall,
Yeah.
a little
Yes,
shaky.
it could be a little shaky,
That's
yeah.
my takeaway in scientific terms, of course.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your move to the private sector. You join Lithium Energy as Chief Executive Officer. Have a great run there. Talk about that evolution. You're probably late 30s, maybe sniffing 40 by the time you move to the private sector, somewhere
Yeah,
around there.
that's it. So I was sort of mid-30s, round about that sort of time. And nuclear actually looked like round about sort of 2014, 2015. I moved to North America in 2016, but nuclear industry looked like it was on a bit of a decline. And I thought this is a good opportunity to actually move abroad and have a bit of adventure and see something else. And I moved over to North America where I began helping companies build projects using that mining masters that I originally had, like I was helping to build a silver mine, lithium projects, and from that I got more involved in the development of early stage lithium projects because at that time there was a big lithium boom, and so there was a lot of money in that sector, and there was a lot of people examining prospects. But I also was involved in gold projects and all that kind of thing, and I did that for a number of years before I got obviously involved in Aries Strategic Mining, which came around about 2020. But like that was there was a that transition to the private sector was it was kind of nice because the private sector is more rewarding of innovation, I would say, and hard work. Whereas I think in the public sector, you are normally part of a much larger bureaucracy that has to move at a certain pace, and your effort does not affect that, and you have to move with the system. And in the private sector, there is an advantage where you can move the needle if you're innovative enough to come up with ideas to that people are interested in. So that was kind of nice to be to have that ability to then move a bit more freely. So.
Fantastic. And the move to North America, is that when you moved to Vancouver, or was that with the somewhere in between?
So it actually originally I ended up in like northern Canada, so the remote the really remote areas where like it's you're essentially surrounded by tundra. But I was only there for about 5, 6 months, and then I moved down to Canada, Vancouver, because Vancouver is a sort of mining hub, and there's a lot of companies that get run out of Vancouver. So even though projects were in Arizona or Nevada or Argentina, typically a lot of the headquarters for all of these operations were Vancouver. So it was a sort of a logical place to end up in Canada. So,
Yeah, it's a great city. We spent time there in 2010 at the Vancouver Olympics, the Winter Games. And then with my family, we went out there. And what a beautiful city it is.
yes, I couldn't believe how beautiful it was. So, just north of Vancouver, it's got beautiful mountains all around there. And I really was walking around it when I first moved down here and thought this is spectacularly beautiful. Like, really, that sort of postcard image people have of Canada with mountains and lakes and mounties and bears, that's all very real. Yeah, you can. It's not even that far away. You can get up there.
Yeah, and
And there was a
it doesn't really get cold. It's like it's a you would think, oh, you have that they what do they call it? A temperate climate, I think they
Yes,
call it.
it has the same benefit that actually England has the Gulf Stream, which keeps it warm where it should freeze over, but that same sort of stream is replicated from the Pacific for Canada, for the West Coast. So like the rest of Canada will freeze over in winter. Like you'll get minus 40, minus 50 degree temperatures, but in Vancouver, zero, minus five, that's really as low as it'll get. And that's why everyone wants to live here, because like Canada, the rest of Canada during winter is not hospitable. It's not really
Right,
livable.
right. Little tough, no question. So you clearly built a tremendous foundation from every vantage point on, so let's call it all things nuclear. Let's talk about the journey to nanonuclear and really you worked on it right from go. And let's talk about the vision for the company, where we are today, and the broader challenge of, let's call it rebranding nuclear.
Yes. So how that happened is actually, funnily enough, even though it's nuclear, the connection with the president who was the founder, JU, came about because I'd helped build a silver company a few years ago, and one of the geologists on that was someone I'd been working with who happened to be working with the founder, JU, on a gold project. But his background was Wall Street, Deutsche Bank, that kind of thing. But his analysis of the market was that it was going in the direction of energy. And his analysis was that it has to be nuclear because it's not locationally dependent. You need high capacity factors for grid systems. Countries that try to move away from nuclear actually suffered quite a lot. Like Germany moved away from nuclear to pursue other renewables and suffered tremendously and actually had to buy in power from Poland that was powered by coal and power from France that was nuclear power. So its energy bills went up and its carbon footprint went up. And based on
Let's pause for a second here because it's an important part of the story. So nuclear went through a period where it was very much in favor. And there were a series of, let's call them unfortunate incidents that led to a loss of that favor and a sort of global sense that, whoa, stop. Sort of like when the 737, Boeing jets, the what was it, the whatever the MAX jets start, two of them fell out of the sky. Everybody says, stop, no more.
Yeah,
Ground all those
exactly.
planes for like 2 years. So nuclear falls way out of favor globally. You see opportunity there. Let's talk about how that tide has started to turn. You say Germany didn't do well. Well, because they had a big power source and they then took that offline. And it's hard to replace that amount of energy. Again, speaking as a layman, but isn't that sort of what happened?
That is exactly what happened. And actually, countries that moved away from nuclear began universally having difficulties. So, for instance, even in the UK, they began to gradually move away from nuclear and not revamp their facilities. And so, what ended up happening is that they became very dependent on Russian gas. And a lot of countries actually lost energy sovereignty because they weren't reinvesting in their nuclear infrastructure. And that was making them very dependent on countries like Russia. And when it came to the Ukrainian war, as an example, they realized the folly of not having energy sovereignty and being reliant on essentially what had become an enemy that really constrained your ability to your diplomatic ability. And the US as well, it was guilty of the same thing. It was the US allowed a lot of its infrastructure to atrophy. So because it was buying Russian material, and it was taking that Russian material and it was downblending it to meet its domestic needs in the nuclear industry. Now, when it became into essentially proxy conflict with Russia, it had to take drastic steps to try and rebuild its infrastructure to move it away from that dependence on Russia. And so we've seen that now from the government, big RFPs, billions of dollars moving back into the nuclear industry to build back the nuclear infrastructure in the US to give it that energy sovereignty that's a consistent form of power that they have autonomy over within country, and it gets them off reliance on foreign material and energy sources. And it's also partly a move to try and move away from even things like oil and gas, which are big components of the infrastructure, but there's still a lot of those components are sourced from the Middle East and things like that. And again, that can put you at a disadvantage when it comes to your own ability to operate on a foreign level.
So what we will now call nuclear very much in that renewable energy, you know, lane, that's the lane that we're in. What you just touched on really is all the geopolitical considerations, which are weigh very heavily in the equation, I would think.
They did substantially. I would say the geopolitical things were as important as the move to try and move towards a reducing the carbon footprint of industry. Because obviously nuclear doesn't produce carbon. That's a big benefit in its favor. But the geopolitics of energy massively did influence the decisions. And even from the US military point of view, their ability to be able to sustain bases, they have mandates to be able to self-power each base independently for a couple of weeks, as an example. But they currently, a lot of them run on diesel generators and not able to fulfill that mandate that they already have. And so they even the military are looking at nuclear solutions to power these bases so they can meet their own mandates. So there's this internal and external pressure that pushed government and the world basically back into nuclear. And let's say COP28, internationally, there was an agreement with the big nations of the world that there would be a tripling of nuclear by 2050 to try and address these big geopolitical issues. But it wasn't just government and geopolitical issues. This happened at the exact same time that AI and data centers, their energy usage were beginning to really creep up and become commensurate, or the projections were commensurate with cities almost. And they suffered from the ability that they can't just site wind and solar wherever they want, or geothermal or hydro, and they're not going to build their own coal plant and or transmission lines. And a lot of these tech centers, Microsoft, Google, they are now looking at nuclear solutions to power these facilities because there's going to be a bottleneck of energy where they will not have enough to keep expanding. So nuclear has come at a time now that's kind of unprecedented, where the government is almost forced into a position where they have to build back nuclear, but industry is also having to opt for a nuclear solution to be able to sustain its own growth.
Okay, so I think I'm drowning here in this conversation, but let me try to make some sense of it. So we've got an initial concern globally over safety that causes nuclear to fall out of favor. That creates a series of geopolitical dominoes, overdependence on Russian gas for Europe and the UK, continued dependence on oil from the Middle East. And then we've got, looking ahead to today, a huge increase in energy demand driven by technology. Huge needs, much higher than what we've seen before, exponential increase in demand. Talk about the journey to address those initial concerns around safety in 2024 as we look at what sounds like a dramatic explosion, let's say that in a good way, of nuclear energy.
Yeah. So it's interesting because it was the Fukushima incident, which really, I think, started the decline in national interests. And that sort of happened, I can't remember the year now, but like 2013, 2014, the industry was on the decline principally because of Fukushima. But even in that sort of incident, those plants were subject to earthquakes and tidal waves, and still nobody died in those incidents. So I always like to try and point out that if you look at deaths per gigawatt hour, nuclear is still the safest form of energy ever devised, like even beats out wind and solar in terms of deaths per gigawatt hour. But it's been getting safer ever since its introduction. But the reason why I think there's more appetite for the next generation of nuclear is because as you take these big power plants and you shrink them down to a small modular reactor, which is a condensed version of a big reactor, it outputs less power, but it's smaller, more simple. Because you've simplified the mechanical systems and the systems involved, the ways that it can fail are also reduced. And so you get a safer system even still. So it's safest form of energy, safer again. And nano, for instance, we're concentrating on the microreactor side of things because the industries we're targeting are remote. So mining sites, oil and gas sites, military bases, disaster relief areas, island communities. There are hundreds of thousands of these places where diesel predominates and it has no competition. But as you shrink an SMR down to a microreactor, it gets even more simple to the point where it's not just the safest form of energy, but overwhelmingly safer than everything else. And there's even if everything was to simultaneously break within a microreactor, it can't have the sort of Fukushima incident where in Fukushima, because there was a coolant leak, it was cracked by the earthquake and the coolant leaked out, which led to an overheat. And because it overheated, it melted. And that was the incident in Fukushima. You can't get that with a microreactor because it's a passively cooling system. If everything breaks, the heat naturally is not enough to melt it. So it just radiates out. So the worst accident scenarios are just completely removed from nuclear. And that's why I think there's a greater appetite for this new technology over more conventional systems.
And so many questions now I have. So what you're really doing is going into, let's call them again, old traditional power plants, and you're able to take out sort of the old engine and put in a new engine, but the transmission of that power to where it needs to go, the distribution, you're using some of that old infrastructure. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly right. So with our company, because we're targeting these diesel generators in remote locations, and there's never been a solution to replace these diesel generators on islands or military bases or anything like that. But the microgrids are already in place. So, and a lot of these organizations like mining companies, they run almost all of their remote locations on diesel, but that's very expensive. And it needs a big logistical operation to bring in sort of a daily importation of fuel. Now a microreactor can just output power for 20 years, 15, 20 years. So that logistics just goes away and it cheapens the whole cost of energy. But the grid systems for these projects are already there. So it's just removing that diesel generator and replacing it with a microreactor that just sits there and outputs power in a decarbonizing way, well, in a zero carbon emitting way. It's a very safe system that needs very few people on site. And it helps these companies, these big companies, to meet their carbon goals because they're trying to qualify for credits and tax relief, and they don't want to, and there are increasing amounts of penalties being brought in for pollution. So.
Okay. And looking more broadly, I know that nanonuclear is very involved in the broader industry. You are, you know, on stage at all the American nuclear, all the big conferences in our country and globally. But talk about what the insiders say about rebranding nuclear. Is there a conversation around the image? And let's just call it, in very simple terms, is there a PR problem? And is that something that folks are looking at?
So there definitely is a PR problem with nuclear, because I think because in the past, there was so much government involvement in the commissioning of these big projects, and there was so much government funding, there was no private industry that was really trying to sell nuclear and communicate what was actually going on. So the delta between the reality and the public perception of nuclear is quite divergent. So for instance, if I, earlier on, I said, it's the safest form of energy. If you look at deaths per gigawatt hour, even beating out wind and solar, that jars with the public perception of it. And if people bring up things like waste, we point out that if you were to take all the waste generated from all the reactors and all the nuclear programs in the United States ever since the 1950s when this started, and you were to take all that waste and put it in one place, it wouldn't fill a football field. So like the waste is a minor issue because it produces so little, and it produces so little because the energy is so compact within uranium, like hundreds, millions of times more dense than oil and gas. And because there's this big delta in perception versus reality, we're trying to get that message out there to try and get it to resonate with the public. And we are seeing some very gradual improvements in the national sentiment towards nuclear. But you still will always get asked the same questions. Like one thing we get asked a lot is, could this reactor be used as a dirty bomb? And you have to point out that reactors one cannot blow up. They cannot be made into a bomb. If you were to actually blow up a reactor, you would actually separate the fuel, which would make it less dangerous. Because the way fuel works in a reactor is that if you push it together, it reaches a critical mass where there's enough uranium to create a chain reaction to produce that heat. Now, if you blow that up, that critical mass doesn't exist anymore, and it actually gets cooler and safer, ironically. And so the good part here is that we just need to keep running through the facts, but I think it's going to be a continuous messaging issue that's going to have to be put in place. And when people say, there's no history of microreactors, we say, actually, microreactors in the 50s, 60s, loads of universities across the US built their own microreactors. And actually, some of them are still operating at university campuses to this day. They've just never had an incident. And students, hundreds of thousands of them, have walked past these things and not even known they're there. So it's that kind of thing that you need to try and get out there. This has been done before.
I mean, this is certainly a very, gee, I didn't know that conversation for me. And I do think that going forward industry-wide, there's a lot of headroom in really dedicating a proper resource to looking at closing that gap between perception and reality. I think it's a really interesting opportunity in a lot of ways. So let's talk about how NanoNuclear is doing. You're a couple of years in. You're out there. You're, pounding the pavement. Let's talk about, give us sort of the current state of NanoNuclear.
Okay. So I mentioned why we went the microreactor route, but as soon as we started, so the first thing we did was we went out and found the best teams we possibly could. So the first technical team we brought on was professors, engineers, and scientists out of the University of Berkeley, California. They had an extensive nuclear background and a lot of experience in microreactor design. And we brought them on to work on the Zeus reactor. And then we went on and we brought in the best scientists we could find in Europe, essentially. And the reason why we did that is so we had two paths to success. And then if one was to fail, then the other one would supplement. But they could also complement each other, and the scientists could liaise with each other to optimize each other's design. Because we were trying to come at this from a very business-orientated view. So we brought in scientists and professors out of University of Cambridge in the UK. And they got to work on the Odin reactor. Now we've moved past the concept phase. We've done all that computer modeling. We're now starting to build physical rigs. So later this year, you'll start seeing photos coming out of the company of these big rigs that are being established to validate the models that we've modeled. And that should put us pretty much in joint lead with a couple of other microreactor companies to produce a final commercial product. And that information will all be collecting data that we then need to go to the licensing agency to get permission to produce this commercial product. how Nano, I think, became very different very quickly is because it had a very business orientated start. A lot of the management was looking at the supply chain of how the reactor actually gets built. And it was very clear from things we talked about earlier in the podcast that there were big fuel supply issues, supply chain issues with the US infrastructure that had resulted from that reliance on that Russian material. And we actually brought these issues up with the Department of Energy and National Labs, and they directed us to say, look, if you were to go and build your own fuel fabrication facility, as an example, it would be the only one of its kind in the country. It would somewhat de-risk your fuel supply. And it would also provide a way for you to provide fuel for all these other companies as well. And so the company found land to go and do that. It brought in a scientific team to do the design work on that facility. And we've just finished an IPO just recently where we raised money specifically so we can do that design work and go out there and do it. And the good part here is that we know this is a project that the DOE will be very supportive of, because it'll be the only one of its kind, and they'll want to invest money in making sure this facility is there to facilitate this sort of resurgent nuclear industry. So there's no such thing as working in nuclear unless you're working with the government. You have to, like, and but it's beneficial because there are national requirements for energy. There is funding opportunity for energy, and they want energy sovereignty. And so even though we're private and most of the work we do is private, there will obviously be synergy with the government as we try and help each other out. So
what a great, great story. And when are we looking at deployment of commercial product? 25, 26? What's that window of time?
So actually, when the rig work is all done, we'll have our prototype reactor. And that will occur sometime around about 2026, 2027. But, well, 2026, I would say. But at that point, the licensing for a nuclear reactor is a fairly long process. You're looking at about 40 months, and that takes us out to about 2030. And so I think the first microreactors of any company in the world, it's not really going to happen before 2030. And we're hoping to be the first in the world to produce that commercial product. What I would say is that SMRs are more developed. So the small modular reactors, they are more developed in the microreactor space. And you will start seeing those go out the door before the end of this decade, 2027, 2028, powering cities, powering big industry projects. And the good thing about nuclear is that, unlike a lot of other forms of energy, the primary thing it produces is heat. And that process heat is very valuable for big chemical plants, for processing facilities. And so you can immediately just build these SMRs to decarbonize industry very quickly. And you'll see them occurring before microreactors go out the door and start knocking off diesel generators in tens of thousands of different locations throughout the world.
So it sounds like in the medium and long term, if I'm going to Caesar's Palace, I should put $100 on nuclear.
I think the sentiment for nuclear, and we're seeing this in the markets, like the markets are always a good indication of where money believes the future is. I mean, that's essentially what they are. And you can see stocks dropping off in wind and solar. They're coming down a lot. But in the nuclear industry, stocks that are related to nuclear energy are beginning to increase. And you can see it's because there's a long-term hedge that nuclear is going to be the solution that's going to come in here. And all that's really happening is that all the investment is just wondering which will be the successful nuclear company. But the overall trend is up, because the money is going in there betting on the future being nuclear.
So, all right, I don't want to skirt too close to insider trading here.
Oh, no. Me neither.
I'm kidding. So let's talk about where we're going to see you in person and what brought us together initially, which is Climatech. I'd love to get your little preview about what you're going to talk about. But let's also talk about, you know, what's your take on what we're trying to do in Boston? You know, bringing so many disparate voices and expertise. You know, we got everything from hydro to seaweed to nuclear to, you know, this, you know, my friend Peter McGinnis, the CEO of Impossible Foods, and talking about the food supply, covering a very broad spectrum. But from the outside looking in, I'd love your honest take on what we are cooking up in Boston.
Oh, look, My personal opinion, even though the nuclear company, maybe my nuclear counterparts would be annoyed for saying this, but the future is a multifaceted approach to provide a clean, energy-rich future for everybody. And that's not going to come from just one energy source. There's going to be a lot of solutions that can go into this. I think there's enormous potential for geothermal, for wind, for solar, for places where these things fit. But the good part here is that I think everything has its place. And even things like you mentioned, just hydrogen, just then, that has a very significant place, I think, in the whole solution of this. I don't want to be one of the companies that just says nuclear will do it all or could do it all. I mean, to an extent, maybe that's true, but it's not going to be the optimal solution in every scenario. And Climatech is very good because it's examining everything. It's not limiting its scope. It's broad-minded enough to say, we're willing to consider all possibilities. Bring your ideas under scrutiny. It's fine. Come and see what we've got to offer. And that kind of thing I think is very useful because we don't want to compete with a lot of these other vendors and these other companies. I think these things can be very complementary, and over time there's going to be partnerships between interdisciplinary companies that we can assist each other.
Well, that was a tremendous unscripted answer. I want our audience to know that no ethics rules were violated in crafting James's answers to that last question. But thank you, and we're looking forward to it all. I want to thank Wayne again for the connection and his diligence and follow up and follow through. We're thrilled to have nanonuclear on the agenda. This was a very heady conversation for me. If Mr. Posner or his descendants are listening from Cardozo High School in Bayside, Queens, I hope I have done the physics department proud, and look forward to having you next week in Boston with us at Climatech, James. And thanks so much for spending some time with us on this
No problem.
Climatech very special edition of Great Minds.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for having me on, Matthew. This was good fun. So
We'll see you next week.